Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this panel on retail central bank digital currencies. Today we'll be exploring the motivations, implementation strategies, design features, and policy implications of a retail CBDC. I'm Kay Chan Wilson from the Digital Monetary Institute here at OnFit, and today I have the pleasure of introducing my esteemed panel, perfectly suited to share with us their latest thinking on retail CBDC. We have Hannah Armelius, Senior Advisor from the Central Bank of Sweden, Neha Narula, Director from the Digital Currency Initiative, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Jose Fernandez de Ponte, Vice President and General Manager for Blockchain, Crypto, and Digital Currencies at PayPal. We also have Athol Butcher, Executive Director and Group Payments Head, DBS. Welcome to you all and to our attendees from across the globe. Now, if you do have any questions about the discussion, then please do use the chat function on Swapcard. We've also got a couple of polls, so I encourage you to vote on those. The polls comprise of which major economy or economic area will be the first to launch a retail CBDC, excluding China. We have Eurozone, United Kingdom, the US, Japan, and other. And then what are the biggest challenges to a retail CBDC implementation? Multiple options from consumer adoption, political consideration, and technology readiness. We'll return to that, though, in the panel. Now, to start with, any initial conversation on CBDC, we should start with the motivations. Why do we even need to embark on a retail CBDC? It's clear that there's huge pressure to do something about it. It's growing. We've seen in the past few weeks the Bank of England make an announcement regarding a CBDC task force. Norges Bank said that they'll be testing a technical solution. But each central bank will be defining why they need to do this before they begin realizing how it's going to work. So, Hannah, I'd love to turn to you first. As a major mover in this space, Sweden seems some way ahead of implementing a CBDC compared to other major jurisdictions. We know the declining use of cash plays a significant role, but can you just tell us a little bit more why this is so significant in the Swedish context?
Yes, well, basically, I mean, the motivation for the eKrona project for the Riksbank has been the declining use of cash in Sweden. For us, that is an important question because we have been supplying money to the Swedish economy for more than 300 years. And we started to think about when we saw cash declining and we saw that it was becoming more and more common for shops and restaurants to not accept cash. Then we started to think about if that could have implications for society, if the general public does not have access to central bank money anymore. So that has always been the motivation in Sweden. And actually, we had sent in an inquiry to the parliament. We had sent in a petition to the parliament to ask them to put together an inquiry to see what role they think that the central bank should have, or the government in general, on the payment market in the future. And that inquiry has just started. So we're very excited about that now. I don't know if you want me to tell you a little bit more about the project or if you were just wanted to know about the motivation.
Well, if you could touch upon some of the biggest challenges you're looking at, I think now, like how far you've come and what's your focus at this point?
Yes. So we have been working together with Accenture to develop a possible technical solution for an eKrona for a year now. And we have just decided to extend that contract for another year. Because there are some features that we believe can be important if we were to decide to issue an eKrona that we have not had time to explore yet. One of those being offline functionality. And that is quite a big challenge, but we will have to work out possible solutions for that. And also we are going to bring in this next phase possible intermediaries that can test the solution that we have now developed for a year. So we will be working together with those like banks or payment service providers that would actually be supplying eKrona to the consumers. And that is also a way of testing the solution if it works. So basically the project is rolling along as we had planned. When it becomes more realistic, of course, then we also get to test the DLT-based technology, for instance, that this technical solution is based on. If that also will work for payments on a large scale. I mean, we know that it works now in the testable solution, but it also is good to bring in the payment service providers and the banks. I also want to mention that this is just one possible technical solution that we're working with. The eCorona project is a lot bigger than that. We also have a legal work stream and we have a policy work stream. If the parliamentary inquiry decide that they want an eCorona and we decide to launch one, then we would have to make a new procurement, and we haven't decided that this will be the technical solution that we would choose. But it's always good for us to learn more about possible technologies, as well as exploring legal options and other policy options. Thank you.
I think you raised some fascinating points, especially on the legal aspects. And I think what other central banks will find exactly the same is you have to consider legislative changes and also political changes, political cycles. All these things can impact the implementation. And offline functionality, I mean, we've just heard from the Sand Dollar from the Bahamas that they've solved this. So lots of, I think, lessons learned from them. Just staying on motivations now, I'd love to ask you, Nehar. I think you and the MIT, I think you've and the Boston Fed, collaborated on digital currency research last year. It's still ongoing. So I'd love to just hear from you your potential motivations when you're looking at digital currency in this way.
Certainly. I think many different organizations have different motivations. For some central banks like the Bahamas, it's really about financial inclusion and accessibility and the hope that central bank digital currency might be a form of electronic money that's more accessible to people. Others are more interested in making payments more efficient, for example, bringing down costs. And others are interested in central bank digital currency as a platform for innovation. So I think there are a lot of different motivations. And part of the trouble sometimes is that there are so many different motivations for why one would launch a CBDC, but it's not exactly clear, you know, what is the driving motivation. And so right now, I think a lot of people are experimenting and trying to understand that. And that's really the context of our work. Our work is technical research that we're doing together. It's a research collaboration. We've been working for the past year on a few different potential architectures for CBDC. And I think the goal here is really to experiment and to understand the trade-offs. So only by implementing, only by actually getting your hands dirty, really trying to build it out, can you even begin to understand and surface some of the most important questions, legal questions, policy questions, economic questions. And as part of our work, what we've realized broadly is that you don't actually want to approach this from a specific technology solution first. Really, it's better to think about what are your goals? What are you trying to achieve with a retail central bank digital currency? And then from that, derive how you want the user to interface with it, how you want it to work, and then sort of come down to what might be the technical options that could help you achieve your goal. But at the same time, it's important to do the technical research first, just to even understand the space of constraints. So that is a lot of what we're doing. We're really trying to understand the space of constraints, what's possible. If you use a certain type of cryptographic technology for privacy, how does that affect the scalability, throughput, and latency of your system, for example? So really getting at questions like that, how to do offline transactions, how to understand the trade-offs and security you might be incorporating with different methods of doing offline transactions. So these are all examples of what we're trying to do.
No, I think that's great. And that really adds to the debate. Actually, you do need to do some of the technical research before you know exactly what you're addressing from the policy side. But just to address the elephant in the room at the moment, what do you see as a benefit to the consumer from this? What can they get out of it? And how would you explain to them, you know, the benefits of the difference between public and private money?
Yeah, well, I think the benefits really depend on exactly how it will be implemented. And right now, what we're seeing in different countries is that it's being implemented in very different ways. I think long term, the potential benefit of this is doing for money and value what the internet did for information. So creating a platform for innovation that people can build upon, where we can have, you know, very new, interesting applications that move around money and value in ways that we only, you know, we only dream about today, or maybe only see the hints and beginnings of in the cryptocurrency world. So the potential benefit, the greatest potential benefit to me, and part of why I'm doing this at a research institution, is the long-term benefit of a platform of innovation in digital central bank money. And I think that, you know, creating it that way will also have several secondary benefits when it comes to access, and incorporating more people into the financial system, but also giving them more options for ways that users can control their financial future.
No, exactly. I think controlling different ways that they can access money and financial inclusion is top priority across the board. Thank you for that. And I'd like to move on now to Jose, and also take a slightly different approach now. And if we look at the common CBDC implementation plan across central banks, this hybrid, this two-tier model, where you have central banks and payment service providers distributing CBDC to the public. Now, I imagine PayPal will play a role in this. I imagine they'll offer CBDC to customers, but how do you envision this strategy? Would you allow some custody of CBDC that allows users to hold it with PayPal? And what are the sort of opportunities and challenges you're looking at in this model at the moment?
Thanks, Katie. I think that the answer of distribution is extremely important, because it goes to the core of something that Hannah just said, which is, in an environment where cash is retreating, how do you ensure that there is a way to put value in the hands of the public? So ensuring universal access is something that we care very, very strongly about. I think it's something that was made evident during the pandemic in the country where I live, in the U.S. last year, when the IRS was trying to direct funds to people in need, and they found out that there were 40 million Americans that did not have banking records on file with the government. So making sure that the distribution is pervasive is something that we believe is an essential feature of any CBDC that would be put in the market. Who should be on those distribution channels, and especially the roles and responsibilities of the people in the distribution channels, will depend a lot on how the central bank decides to implement the CBDC. It's totally different if it is based on a token model than what it would be if it is based on an account model. Who should be in charge of doing KYC and AML from the recipients of those funds? Are all implications that would derive from the design principles of the CBDC, but should be kept in mind as the central banks are thinking about those design principles?
Yeah, no, certainly. But I just wondered if you had any specific plans with PayPal in particular for the future. What's also your current thinking on it in terms of strategically? Or are you waiting for the central banks to act?
Well, the way that we think of PayPal is as a fundamental wallet of value for consumers and businesses, which means that if there are sources of value, should be able to be stored in that wallet, as you can store today your funding instruments, and you can carry a balance with PayPal, or you can have your credit card rewards points stored there. Definitely, when central banks are ready to have currencies that are directed to the public, we want to be part of that channel, because it is important in terms of adding utility to our consumers and merchants. A lot of the infrastructure work that we have been doing last year and our entry into the digital currencies market is to set up that infrastructure that will allow us to hold digital assets on behalf of the public.
Excellent. That sounds great. We'll look out for that in the future. Atul, now moving on to you. Just a quick follow-up from Jose's point on the commercial bank side. If these third-party providers are going to hold this CBDC and offer additional payment services, do you see any implications for commercial banks here?
Yeah, thanks, Kitty, and great to be here. Maybe just taking a step back. I think, you know, in terms of what problem, you know, is digital currency solving, and I guess Neha, you know, hit the nail on the head in terms of, you know, highlighting really the key aspect. You know, at the end of the day, it's about driving innovation. It's about making sure efficiencies come in. It's about financial inclusion. It's about convenience. It's about, you know, also with the COVID-19, you know, it's about, you know, making sure digital solutions, you know, sustainability, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that again comes in when you compare cash and checks. And higher control. So I think, you know, these are really imperatives which, you know, kind of, you know, make it important to realize why digital currency. Now the other aspect really you talked about in terms of, you know, what does it mean really in terms of, you know, digital currencies for commercial banks. So at the end of the day, I think there are a few different aspects to, you know, consider. Really, if you look at, you know, non-banks participating in such platforms, it does drive, you know, clearly depending on, you know, the maturity of the different markets and the state of competition, it does drive innovation. And then clearly, you know, the way we look at it is, you know, these are potentially Lego building blocks. And in the end, you know, it's limited purely by your imagination in terms of what you really want to do with these building blocks. That's key. Obviously, efficiencies do come in, you know, whether you call it more in terms of cost efficiencies or, you know, yeah, so on and so forth. So that's key. And the third element really is in terms of making sure that, it, you know, the whole platform or the whole financial ecosystem becomes open. At the end of the day, it's, you know, increasingly important to be able to make sure that, you know, it's, you know, an open banking ecosystem is something which clearly, you know, from a regulatory perspective, again, it goes back to the first 2 points. So these are a couple of factors which would be important. And maybe I would highlight a fourth dimension, which is really in terms of financial inclusion. We've seen that, you know, in markets, you know, for instance, Asia has really been the epicenter. Asia has been one of the hubs for innovation. And, you know, if you look at China with the ECNY or DCP, you know, so it's not just banks, it's also the non-banks. And, you know, here we're talking of not just the wallet companies, it's also telcos, it's also ride-hailing companies, it's also e-commerce players. So clearly there's a, you know, a wide spectrum, and that in a way also drives to an extent financial inclusion, which, you know, the other fellow panelists did talk about. You know, there are segments, you know, which may not have access to bank accounts. And, you know, with this, you know, it could drive that. That said, there's a flip side, which one needs to be cognizant of. You know, one is really in terms of the whole governance and controls around participants. You know, at the end of the day, you know, and this is quite similar to decisions which regulators have had to take. Markets like Singapore, Hong Kong, UK, where we have non-banks participating in domestic payment systems, whether it's RTGS, whether it's instant 24/7 payment schemes. And it's important to recognize the fact that, you know, systemic risk, you know, is key. You know, whether you want to look at it as settlement risk or, counterparty risk and so on and so forth. So I think it's important to really have that framework. Because at the end, you know, these are very important engines of economic growth, and trust is a key element. The other aspect to kind of take note of, and again, it's not just because I'm speaking on behalf of a commercial bank, is the whole aspect of, it was Roy Amara who said that, you know, we tend to kind of overestimate the effect of technology in the short term and underestimate the effect in long term. So, one area which we definitely would watch out for, you know, at the end of the day, today's financial system is, you know, a fractional reserve banking system. And, you know, the difference between M0 and M1. So the moment, deposits come into commercial banks and becomes M1 is when then you have the money multiplier effect. And at the end of the day, that then becomes the catalyst in terms of lending. And whether it's to SMEs, you know, whether it's access to, capital, whether it's the cost of capital and so on and so forth. So disintermediation, has potential, impacts in terms of, you know, these aspects, which, clearly need to be kind of observed and evaluated closely. And in summary, what I would say is clearly competition is good. At the end of the day, it's about, maybe Charles Darwin said survival of the fittest. That's not something which most commercial banks in most markets are worried about. I think it's really just to make sure that, the unintended consequences, you know, are thought through beforehand. We just make sure that, yeah, the framework is such that, yeah, you know, it becomes a level playing field. Thanks, Gideon.
No, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think banks can innovate and compete, and it could be a good thing. I mean, that just leads me on to my short follow-up question would be the material benefits of commercial banks from the introduction of a CBDC. You've said competition. Are there any sort of examples or rough ideas that you could give how you think that might look, how they can use CBDCs in a more competitive way?
So again, at the end of the day, yeah, it's all about, you know, going back to what problem are we solving with digital currency, and the way we look at it is looking at the customer journey, you know, there are a couple of aspects here which become important because again, you know, if you really go back to the core, so one of the key principles which digital currency solves, really is in terms of making it more convenient, making it more digital, and you know, the way it typically, and that's where, you know, some of the innovations which come in, again, you know, maybe taking a leaf out of the China ECNY book, is in terms of, you know, the fact that to substitute cash, you know, even in an offline mode where there's no internet access, it's, you know, there are solutions available to be able to transfer money, even if it's digital currency in the absence of that. It's also about form factor. At the end of the day, you know, can you maybe even, just by touching two mobile phones, are able to transfer money without even using QR codes, and so on and so forth. It's also about leveraging on things like proxy IDs. You know, you don't need to remember a 12-digit or a 15-digit account number. You don't need to remember which particular bank does the beneficiary bank with. You're able to do it based on, let's say, a mobile number. You're able to do it based on national identification numbers. So all of this drives, you know, in terms of convenience. There are aspects, you know, which gets far more interesting in terms of programmability, but I think maybe let's cover that a bit later. There are elements in terms of, the costs, and especially if you talk about domestic, I think that's important. But as you move into cross-border and as efficiencies really start coming in, because you can leverage the power of digital currency to be able to make, a lot of innovations in terms of how things like pre-validation happen. You know, you can bring in efficiencies in terms of concurrent screening. So all of this drives efficiencies, and it's not just cost. It's even things like access to 24/7 payment systems. It's about access. It's about things like turnaround times. You know, is it a matter of a few seconds or minutes, or is it a matter of hours and days? So all of these aspects really become important, and I think as Neha and the fellow panelists talk about, at the end, it's purely limited by, the power of innovation, and the internet really has been a great precedence to look at. And I think so the use cases are tremendous, and only limited by imagination. Thanks.
Thanks. I think that's a really, really positive message, from Commercial Bank on the panel, and great for our audience to take away. I mean, just as we're on the topic of disintermediation, Hannah, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Of course, we've got risks into central bank money. So from your perspective, how are you addressing these concerns? I mean, Atul has said that he's, not too concerned about it. Are you concerned? How have you addressed the risks? And are there any other risks that are on your mind at the moment?
I have to say that the risk of disintermediation is something that we, of course, take very seriously. We have issued a report where we said that one fundamental principle of the CBDC will be to do no harm to the financial system. And that is something that it's like a red line that we would never cross. There are tools available that can make a CBDC resemble cash in this respect. I mean, we know that cash is already, an alternative to having your money in a bank account. But why don't people do that? Well, you only want to hold a certain amount. There are some frictions, it's costly maybe to have it. So we can have caps and limits or negative interest rates or things like that we can work with. So I'm sure that we can find a solution that sort of resembles the model that we have today, only taken into like a digital future. And that model, of course, is the central bank coexisting with commercial banks and only having like a small presence in the market. So that's basically the way that I view it. I mean, a model that has worked really well for the financial system for hundreds of years, and we'd like to continue that. But like I said, obviously cash needs to have some sort of supplement. We don't want to replace it. We would like for people to be able to continue to use cash. It has some features that are very nice. But if people don't want to use it, then we also have to realize that maybe if we want our money to be used in a digital future, it has to be sort of updated to better fit the technology that people are demanding. But I would also like to say that CBDC is only like one piece of the puzzle here, because the world is changing and there are new players that are coming into the market, and there are new currencies out there that are sort of challenging sovereign money in a way that hasn't really happened before. And what we want to do is, of course, work together with banks and other, you know, actors in the economy to make sure that we have a future that is working, that we like sort of continue the things that we have learned throughout history into the future. Like, we might need a lender of last resort, a deposit insurance scheme. And if we want people to continue using central banks for settlement and our money, then it has to be updated. So other pieces in the puzzle are also better cross-border payments, instant payments, electronic IDs. There are things that need to be developed here, and we would like to do it together with the private market in like a public-private partnership. I think that's the best way to move forward.
Thanks, Hannah. And in this scenario, then, I think where you've said that there's really a risk of not acting at all, how do you ensure adoption by, you know, dominant players? We've got a few questions coming in, you know, saying actually, surely there are concerns that with companies like PayPal, you're squeezing profitability and opportunity. So are you concerned that you need some sort of incentive structure for intermediaries to actually distribute CBDC? Are you looking at that at all?
I mean, like I said, this will be something that we will start working on this year in the project. So basically, we're just in the beginning of this, and we will look more deeply into it. But certainly, there has to be some incentives. Otherwise, private companies will not do something if they don't have any incentives. But like I said, we are only in the beginning of this process now.
Yeah, I think an interesting question is also who bears the cost, but I think that the answer to that will come later. Let's move on now to, I think, looking at design features more broadly, and actually more the approach to design features. Neha, considering that you're coming at this from a completely research and technical basis, I would love to just get your thoughts on the debate and the framing of the debate. I mean, over the last few years, it's been quite binary. We've had DLT versus non-DLT. We've had account-based versus token-based. But actually, what we've seen is a mixture of both on some of the most far-ahead projects. And we've had tiering of account-based and token-based access. So how are you approaching design? And do you find this taxonomy useful?
Yeah, I think the taxonomy has been useful as we've gotten started, but unfortunately it's too simple and it doesn't really take into account the full range of different decisions to be made and how these different features can be combined. So just as an example, let's take token versus account. Unfortunately, those words mean very different things to different people. When economists hear token and account, they think about authentication and identification. Is it the object that is, that you are transferring, or is it done in a custodial sort of third party way? Someone is identifying the person and deciding they have the right to move the funds, for example. Computer scientists might think of it as the data model. Different cryptocurrencies use different data models. And there's a whole wide swath of misunderstanding around this. And what we found is that people often conflate certain architectures or certain features in an effort to simplify the questions and design into these two areas, these two binary areas, when in fact you can actually combine many different features in different ways, as you were just describing, right? So for example, you could imagine a data model that you might see in cryptocurrencies, but it's done with identification at a different layer. Or you can imagine something with accounts that tries to preserve privacy. Either of them could be built with databases or DLT. I really think that's quite frankly, the least interesting question, and something that should be determined only after you've really figured out what is the money, what do you want the money to look like, how do you want users to access it, how should the system, be intermediated, how do third parties interact with it. Then you can go back to, okay, what's the right technology choice here? Well, the underlying sort of data structure technology choice. So, and even within these different choices, it's really a spectrum. And we see that in the world today. You can't just say Bitcoin is a token and bank accounts are accounts. There's even been a lot of debate around that very topic about, the ledger inside Bitcoin and whether it's really representing an account-like structure for economists. So, really, I think, these models are helpful to get us started, but I don't think they're going to get us all the way there. And we really need to dive in and to start to define these things better, define the spectrum, and explain, most importantly, that we can combine different choices in different ways, that you're not just limited to one side or the other, and what that might imply.
No, I think that's fascinating. And exactly what we wanted the symposium to do is to move the agenda along and to broaden thinking. So that's great to hear you say that. And I think the point on the slight danger that decision makers come to believe that certain benefits are uniquely associated with either design features when actually they can merge, I think is really crucial here. So we shouldn't get too sucked in to those binary understandings. So it seems then, from what you're saying, that design features aren't conditional on the technology. So if we leave the approach to design to the one side then, and we look at it from a policy implications perspective, I mean, Jose, how cash-like should a CBDC actually be?
That's another one, like account versus token, the topics that is very controversial, but is maybe a little bit misguided when we think about it. We were talking about design. I think the design principles should be clear, and probably the two most relevant things are universal access and financial stability, and those should be preserved. When we think about the features of the product itself, we need to provide the public with some affordances and relate these to something that is they're already familiar with, or we will fall into the adoption issue that we were discussing before. Is this closer to a dollar bill or an euro bill or a pound, or is it closer to a bank account? But in that sense, cash is just another affordance. As Hannah was just saying, cash has very desirable features. I think that universal access is right up there. There are other features of cash that are probably less relevant. Do we need a CBDC to enable only push-only transfers? Probably that's not the case. How do we enable AML and prevent illicit financial crime is probably different with a digital currency than it is with physical cash. So there are cash-like features that should be preserved. There are very good uses for cash. But do we need a CBDC to be just a digital representation of cash as is? Probably not. I think that hopefully between all of us, we can do something that is better than physical cash.
And what about this privacy element? Do you think we've moved on from it could be fully anonymous? I think we've seen the central bank say there's no way we're going to do it fully anonymous. Let's forget that completely. What's left then within the privacy debate to discuss?
Oh, there's a ton to discuss. Going back to your point on cash, there is this perception that cash is fully anonymous. It is not. It's constrained by regulation, right? There is not a perception that you will be able to do a $100,000 euro transaction in cash without reporting it. So you can enforce AML provisions through regulation that accompanies the token or the device that you are using. Privacy is definitely one very important factor. Again, goes back to be more of a policy question about what is the level of privacy and the combination of preservation of privacy versus AML controls. And how do you embed that into either the product itself or the regulation that accompanies the product? But absolutely a lot of debate about, and different countries will have different sensitivities about where do you put that hurdle?
Yeah. And I mean, Hannah, just if you have any thoughts on the privacy element and how you're looking at it, I'd love to just get them before we move on.
I mean, the model that we have been building has had sort of an aim to resemble the way that cash is distributed into society. So there, the central bank would not have all of the information for all of the customers. I mean, it would be the intermediaries that do the KYC and ALM, and in the end, the nodes will have the information, but the central bank won't see it all, basically. But that's just, like I said, just one possibility. But I think anyway, privacy is important, and it can be designed. I mean, like Nia said, if that's the policy goal that you have, it can certainly be designed into the feature of the CBDC.
Yeah. And this model, I think, of the central bank viewing transactions, but not the identity, is one that also the PBOC is looking at. So it's quite a concurrent model across the board. I just wanted to remind people that they can vote in the polls. Please, they're on the right side of the chat function. Look at what are the biggest challenges to retail CBDC. Let us know your thoughts. We've got financial instability, consumer adoption, digital considerations, private sector participation, privacy and technology. Do let us know and we can try and address them throughout the discussion. We've had quite a lot of comments just referring actually back to this two-tier model and commercial banks. So Athol, I wonder if you could just address this one for us now before we go on to programmability a bit more. We have from Finality asking, if the system does remain two-tier and limits in holdings, what is the benefit of CBDC versus commercial bank accounts with deposit insurance? So we're going back a bit to the commercial bank question, but I think it's an important one to raise.
So again, it goes back to, you know, the basic principles of, yeah, what really is CBDC aiming to solve? And that's the reason I think what Hannah said, you know, was quite precise, that, you know, there are both pros and cons and they have to be weighed carefully, you know. So I think clearly, you know, given the impact on, you know, given the potential impact on the financial, you know, ecosystem, and especially in terms of, you know, the lending aspect, I think has to be really considered. You know, when we were to look at classic commercial bank money, which is, you know, in fiat, you know, kept in traditional accounts, you know, governed with deposit insurance, I think that's what is BAU today. And if you really were to look at, you know, really what does, you know, CBDC, you know, bring in is the elements, you know, which, you know, we talked about a bit earlier. So really, if you were to kind of just, you know, quickly run through them, you know, one was really in terms of, you know, can this, you know, especially in markets which may not potentially, let's say, have a 24/7 instant payment system and so on and so forth, you know, within domestic, it can drive those efficiencies. It can bring in, you know, even from a cross-border perspective, the efficiencies which are there from a cost perspective. Again, so that there's an efficiency play clearly which comes in. There's an innovation play which clearly comes in. There are plays in terms of, you know, when we look at financial inclusion, you know, and again, the fact is that, yeah, there are certain markets where, you know, and again, it really depends on which kind of market we're talking about, what kind of, you know, stage of the life cycle are they in, where, you know, for instance, in markets in Africa, where there would be people, you know, who may not have bank accounts, but who maybe have mobile phones. And if you really then have, you know, this kind of digital currency in, can it drive, you know, further use cases? So, yeah, those are the aspects which one has to really, you know, look at in terms of, you know, the positive aspects. And yeah, there are the downsides, which I did talk about, really in terms of, yeah, you know, the fact that we've got to just consider both of these. But yeah, those are my thoughts, but again, open to any other panelists' thoughts on this.
Maybe at all, and KDN, if I can add, because I think that question goes to somehow to the heart of the matter. I think that one of the important parts of it is, how is it different to commercial banks with commercial bank accounts? Is because commercial bank accounts can only be provided by commercial banks. So if we use a similar token through the same distribution channel, then maybe, yeah, there is not much of a difference. The ability of having a central bank liability that can be distributed by other channels could increase universal access.
Yeah, if I might also chime in on this topic, you know, I think it's often presented as a binary choice. Either it's all through the commercial banks or it's a free-for-all, and we have no way of doing KYC AML. And I think what we have to acknowledge is that it is entirely possible to have a hybrid model where commercial banks can certainly mediate a CBDC and provide services for a CBDC, and perhaps that's even how the majority of people choose to access it. But then there can also be another tier of financial service providers who can access the CBDC and provide it to the public who aren't necessarily commercial banks. And maybe there's a public option as well for financial inclusion and access. So I think really it could be a blended model. It doesn't have to be one way or the other.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer to the question, certainly. And there's just another one that I would like to raise before, again, we move on. We've got a question here. If there is a cap on retail CBDC holding, would it be possible that one-to-one parity with fiat may not always hold? What if the markets value cash and CBDC differently? Some put a premium on cash, some on CBDC. What if CBDC could be interest-bearing but cash is not? Will their market values differ? I mean, Neha, do you want to...
I think we should ask an economist or a central banker this question.
Hannah then?
I think that, I mean, to maintain parity, even today, I mean, we have parity between money that we have in our bank accounts, which has an interest rate, and cash, for instance. And usually, or at least in some countries, when you take money out from an ATM machine that's not with your bank, there might be a fee. In Sweden, at least we have fees if you want to do some cash handling in a bank office. So like most cash handling will be, you know, have some fee connected to it, perhaps. And there's still parity between all forms of the Swedish krona that's in the economy. And that has to do with also the fact that, well, first of all, it's exchangeable. So you know that if you have a krona in your bank account, then it is exchangeable for cash if you want to. But it also has to do with the fact that there are bank reserves in the central bank system. So when they make payments between each other, it's also interchangeable to the reserves on a one-to-one basis. So one bank can't just say, oh, I'm not going to accept the other bank's money. I'm going to, you know, have a surcharge or something like that, because they can all run through the central bank. So that is something that we want to maintain. We don't want some market value of something to drift astray, but I think that can be easily handled if we just maintain sort of the same model that we have been doing with commercial bank money, cash, and central bank reserves. But that's also why it's important to have a central bank in the middle of the system. So yeah. Once again, I mean, if we can maintain some form of model that's working really well, because this hasn't always been the case throughout history. There has been cases where a banknote did not have the same value in one part of a country as in another part, because this was not working really well. So that we definitely don't want to go back to something like that. So that's why we're working on updating this together with the financial market.
Atul, I don't know if you want to chime in here.
No, I think Hannah said it all. At the end, yeah, there ought not to be any arbitrage. There ought not to be any speculative element. And I know the moment there is, you know, especially, you know, I think with some of the digital assets or some of the crypto, world, there are those speculative aspects which come in. The tools which Hannah talked about, I think, are very, very important to ensure that, yeah, there is a 1:1. Parity to ensure. Yeah. Thanks.
And then, I mean, just to come back on that, if the answer to the difference between commercial banks or open seas, and would that hybrid institution be effectively a narrow bank? That's the sort of response that we've had to the answer. Hannah, do you want to come in on that? Does that make sense? So would the hybrid institution be effectively a narrow bank?
Are we talking about the possible intermediaries here?
Yes.
Well, no. I mean, the intermediaries could be any payment service provider or a commercial bank. I mean, they wouldn't have to be. I mean, there is something that, once again, we are here with the different terminologies that really need to be, I guess, put in place. But something called a synthetic CBDC. Maybe that's why. I mean, that's sometimes people are referring to as would be very similar to a narrow bank. But I mean, I think the hybrid model does not at all include only something that would resemble narrow banks. That could be banks that have large balance sheets where they, you know, create commercial bank money and make lending, you know, and then just as with cash. I mean, it's really the simplest way to think about it. Commercial banks, they provide cash today to their customers, but cash is actually a liability of the central bank. But that doesn't really, make them not able to do all of their other business as usual. So,
yeah, no, certainly. And let's move on to the programmability issue, because we've got a few more questions coming in on that. And I think it's also closely related to the discussion we were having on whether it should be cash or not, moving financial stability and hybrid models to aside for 1 second. So this idea of programmable CBDC, we know that CBDC could be used to direct transfers to the public, this sort of helicopter drops, but then on top of that, you have this potential for expiry dates, you know, conditional spending on certain goods. What do you see as some of the advantages and disadvantages of this programmability element? And maybe at all, if you could start us off with maybe a look from Asia, it would be quite interesting. Some use cases or potential approach for Asia would be interesting.
Sure. So, Kitian, what you said, exactly makes a lot of sense. So if you really look at, what the difference is between electronic money today and digital currencies or digital money, I think the most powerful, differentiator really is the whole aspect of programmability. And I guess that comes in, by leveraging on smart contracts or what you have. And, and that's what I call moving from, the BAU to IAU or the innovation as usual, instead of business as usual. And clearly, if you were to look at, some of the markets, China is really, I think miles ahead in terms of, close to launch and really the pilots which have happened across markets, Cambodia again with the retail CBDCs, really got a track record now. But, so really, if you look at, maybe I'll just touch upon two use cases. One, really you talked about in terms of, the whole stimulus and really to be able to, ensure that, there is, the end of the day expiry, so potentially the so-called red packets, which maybe, can be given by governments to consumers to ensure in terms of the end use that, the end use has to be done within a certain number of weeks. It has to be done in terms of, let's say, potentially only for use at supermarkets, not maybe at an alcohol store, to be able to ensure, it has to be done in a periphery, which is, within this particular geography, area. So all of those aspects and to ensure that really it drives consumption, it's not something which just lies in the account and doesn't get used. So, this particular use case really becomes interesting. The other aspect really is about the whole element of, whether you call it maybe an ecosystem play, leveraging on conditional payments. So maybe a transaction as simple as a sale and purchase of property. And again, depending on which markets we're talking about, there tend to be, accounts which we call escrow accounts, which tend to be used for such transactions. So a simple use case really is when there's a buyer and a seller, some of the markets, Singapore for instance, you have to deposit a certain amount of money, which is a percentage of the purchase value, into what is called a conveyancing account, and that money then resides in that account for a couple of weeks while there are different checks which are done. So this could be in terms of checking whether the property title actually belongs to indeed the seller. Needs checks are in terms of whether if the buyer is taking a mortgage, is that mortgage approved and what's the amount. There tend to be also, accounts which are called, equivalent to a central provident fund account. And again, they can be used for financing. So there are different components of these financial transactions. And even though the money or the funds are actually moving, between two different, let's say, potentially consumers, you realize that in terms of it being, the financial ecosystem getting an end-to-end digital solution is where this programmability becomes key. And each of these checks, can all be made, into smart contracts, which will then drive efficiencies in terms of, instead of this taking a few weeks, up to a couple of months, this could potentially happen in minutes, if not, faster. So yeah, so those are, a couple of use cases which we see really becoming very interesting. But maybe I'll again open it up to, any other panelists. Thanks.
Then Neha, do you have any thoughts on the programmability and how it links to the consumer benefit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is something I'm quite excited about. I think this is what could make CBDC a platform for innovation. At the same time, this kind of links back to the previous question around compatibility and why, how do we make sure that CBDC and cash and bank accounts trade at par? If there is a CBDC that is encumbered in such a way that it can only be used in certain places or, something about it that makes it less desirable to consumers, that will affect the ability for that CBDC to trade at par. So I think it's quite exciting. And there's a whole wide world of different types of, programmability that we can enable. And some of that functionality is going to be critical. For example, multi-factor authentication, escrow as a tool just described. But at the same time, we have to think about the second order effects of what programmability means and what that's going to mean for users. And I think this is a broader principle in general for everyone to understand. You can try to design CBDC exactly how you think it should be used. You can put restrictions in place. You can say things, but users are going to find ways around that. They're going to do all sorts of different types of things. That's part of why at MIT, we're also engaging in user research. We think that that's quite important to understand how end users are going to evaluate this, how they're going to think about it, to try to surface some of these issues sooner rather than later. So I think programmability is very exciting, but I think we have to also be very conscious of fungibility and exchangeability, and make sure that we're considering that as well.
And Jose, what about from your perspective? Do you see the benefits of programmable money?
I think there's a ton of upside in many of the things that Atul and Neha suggested, and I fully agree with them. One thing that I would add probably is on the compliance side. So if you have the ability to embed compliance in the protocol itself, we can leave behind the days in which when someone was detecting some suspicious activity, you would go and write a suspicious activity report and send it to a fax. I think that we can do better than that and have a pile of faxes that someone needs to go and review manually. It has to be very carefully thought of, because one of the things you don't want as Neha was saying, you don't want to encumber too much the CBDC so that people will flow to somewhere else. But programming compliance into the transaction system is something that we are super excited about.
Yeah.
I think reiterate what Jose mentioned. I think that's awesome. And really, if you look at, it's efficiency is not just in terms of the participants, even if you potentially can look at, just becoming as a central utility and, the possibilities. I think that's a very important point. Yeah. Also talked about. Anyway, back to you, Katya.
And Hannah, though, closely related to programmability, though, is the implications for monetary policy. And we know that the central banks have said that the monetary policy motivations are the bottom of the agenda. It's not a top motivation for CBDC. Do you see issues with blurring of monetary and fiscal policy with some of these programmability elements, and sort of how far in the future do you think you'll be with until central banks begin to think about them properly? If you could look into a crystal ball.
Well, that's a very difficult question. But I think, once again, I mean, it's kind of boring to go back to the same answers, but it will be different in different jurisdictions. In Sweden, I don't really see, I mean, okay, let me put it this way. What we would like to achieve is something like NEA is discussing, like a platform where there can be innovation from the private market and, where we can offer something that's good. And one thing that we have found with the solution that we're testing is that an advantage that it has is that it might be a more efficient, like, parallel system to the account-based system that we have working today. That I just wanted to bring that up, because that's not programmability per se, but it might be another, efficiency advantage. But as far as using, programmable money for monetary policy and things like that, I don't really, I mean, that's not something that we have thought about at all. And in Sweden, the government has no problem, I think, reaching the whole population. We have like a welfare state, so it's not something that you really need programmable money for. And I also think, we could talk about this for a whole nother hour, but things like, making money only valuable for a certain amount of time and stuff like that. I mean, there's always like this, well, then I might just use the central bank money when I go shopping. It doesn't necessarily mean that I will consume more if I do have some money in my bank account, I'm not going to go into any details, but I'm just going to say that it's not something that's, at the table at all for the Riksbank. But I think maybe for some other government authorities, like, for instance, the tax authority might like it if it's possible to make an instant VAT payment or something like that. I mean, there are other features than just these very exciting monetary policy stuff that could possibly, but that's not, on our table at all.
Yep, it's not a priority at the moment. But I think the context point that you raise is really, really important, actually. Again, it depends which country and the situation that's needed in. We've got a couple of questions also coming in on cross-border. Although we do have a panel on this at 4:20 today, UK time, very happy to touch upon it. We can move away from the domestic use case, and especially, I guess, considering that at some point non-citizens will use other CBDCs from different jurisdictions. So it is an important question to be raised on the retail side. I mean, Atul, I don't know if you want to share your thoughts on this. What are your current thinking on cross-border CBDCs? Maybe more on the retail side, and actually if we do even need a distinction between retail and wholesale. If we have retail, do we have wholesale?
That's a brilliant point, Katya. And I think some of the recent multi-CBDCs initiatives which have been kick-started For instance, BIS Innovation Hub in Hong Kong, started work in terms of, the so-called connectivity within the China, ECNY, the Hong Kong, Lion Rock or Aurum. You've got the UAE initiative and the project in Thanon and Thailand. And that's interesting to watch. And as we speak, even the BIS Innovation Hub in Singapore, along with MAS, is also kick-started something very similar. So clearly the efficiencies clearly are a given, and we talked about, some of those in terms of, being able to leverage on, the whole programmability or smart contracts to be able to, get things like pre-validation done beforehand, get screening efficiencies, get 24/7, make it faster turnaround time, get traceability, transparency, and so on and so forth. At the end, it clearly from a cost efficiency point of view is important. And of course, the innovations come in, we can technically, define conditions based on which money would move. And that's kind of agnostic to whether, those conditions may be from a domestic or a cross-border perspective. So these aspects are key. The area which I think we are all intently watching, and I guess, I think we all acknowledge that this is an area which is work in progress. Clearly the lines between, wholesale CBDC and a retail CBDC, especially when we talk about interoperability across borders, is something which will be very interesting to watch. We did that, in Singapore with the Monetary Authority of Singapore, and that was Project Jasper and Project Rubin, that interoperability as part of Phase 4. So I'm not sure if I've answered completely your question about, the part about blurring of lines, but maybe I'll just, pause and, if anyone else, would have any other inputs to add.
I mean, Hannah, if you just want to touch upon this, non-citizens' access to CBDC in a different jurisdiction, current thoughts?
I mean, we at the Riksbank are not really there yet where we have made up our minds about this, but I think that a lot of central banks are a bit reluctant to having a possibility, for a lot of use of their currency abroad without any, control over that. But then again, we probably want something that tourists can use if they come to the country, in particular if cash is not really an option for tourists. I mean, once again, maybe the line will not be exactly zero or one, or there will be some, intermediary solution here. But I mean, the cross-border, aspects are important to the Riksbank, and something that we're very excited about, the international work that's going on now. But I think, that can also be solved by having common standards and protocols on how to make different CBDC designs, talk to each other in an efficient way. It doesn't necessarily mean that the CBDC has to go across border. Thank you.
Yep, I think that's a great answer. I mean, Nihar, Jose, feel free to, if you want to add anything on cross-border, speak now or forever hold your peace.
I would say, Kerianna, to your question about if we have retail, do we still need wholesale? Yes, we do need wholesale. So they will serve different purposes. It raises many, many interesting questions there. One of them is interoperability of CBDC. So there is a system in place today that enables currencies to be exchanged between different jurisdictions. But how does that translate to a world of where you have maybe a very instrument issued by a central bank that can be transacted in a different country? It's a fantastically interesting question at a conceptual level. I don't know how it gets implemented. There is a retail component to cross-border. So on the PayPal side, we see that. We operate in 200 markets. We see many consumers interacting with SMBs in different markets. And there are many consumers in the world that don't have a payment instrument today that is enabled for cross-border transactions. You can be sitting in Colombia and wanted to buy from a merchant in Germany, but your locally issued credit card is not enabled for international transactions. So something like this could be a very good use case for a CBDC. Again, we all together need to think about what does that mean, that a CBDC issued in Colombia gets deposited in an account with a German merchant, and what does that mean in terms of monetary policy and supervision? But the need is there.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Neha, anything? Not to worry.
I want to echo what Jose said. I think cross-border is both a retail and a wholesale issue. It's hard to talk about cross-border really without sort of getting at the correspondent banking system as well and sort of what that enables. But, I think there's a definite need for retail cross-border. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that ends up coming out in practice.
Thank you. We've actually come to the end of our session, but if you do want to say any final concluding remarks, any important takeaways you want to leave with the audience, just really, really quick 10 seconds. Neha, we'll go to you first.
I guess my parting note is, it's not binaries. There's many different features to consider in the design of a CBDC, and it's definitely not all or nothing. So we hope to release some information on this soon.
Atul?
I think really the data point that more than 80% of central banks worldwide are either working on assessing or looking at rolling out digital currencies is heartening. So it's not a matter of if, it's now a matter of when. It's just that, yeah, as the panelists did talk about, there are various aspects which have to be carefully considered. I don't think everyone here has the answers, but I think it's an important area where, like I said, it's work in progress.
Jose?
I would say in my mind is about don't lose sight of the guiding principles, which in my mind are non-excludable universal access coupled with financial stability. The rest is detail, and we'll get to the detail.
And Hannah, just to close us off.
Well, thank you. I would just like to say that money has changed form throughout history, and so in that sense, it's not something new. We hope that we can continue to learn and discuss with each other. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you so much, and have a lovely rest of the day.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFifth Podcast.